Well, we're going to continue this afternoon with Paul's second missionary journey, as it's called. I pointed out earlier that that nomenclature isn't exactly a correct description of the way things were, but the second journey that's described in some detail by Luke, and this starts in Acts chapter 16, runs through 17 and 18, the journey that we're talking about here, Acts chapter 16, 17 and 18. When we come into Acts chapter 16, again, Paul and Barnabas have gone in separate directions. Paul has taken Silas. Barnabas has taken John Mark. Barnabas has gone to Cyprus. We don't know any more about that trip, but we know about Paul's trip with Silas as they went north and then west to Derbe and to Lystra. And when they came to Lystra, there was there a young man named Timothy who was well spoken of by the churches in Lystra and Iconium. And it says Paul had in mind to take him along. I might spend more time on this than I will if it weren't for the fact that John talked about this in his class on Timothy a couple of days ago. And so I won't deal with it quite so much as I might have. But there at Lystra is a young man who is well spoken of, and Paul saw him as an asset, as a helper, and so he wanted him to come along. And Paul took, you remember, we're kind of right in the middle of this big controversy about circumcision, and yet Paul circumcised this young man, Timothy, in order to take him along. And it says he did that because of the Jews in that region, because they knew that Timothy's mother was Jewish and his father was a Greek. Now, we don't know anything about his father. We do know over in 2 Timothy 1, 5 and 6 there, we do know that Timothy's mother and grandmother were Christians, because Paul makes reference to the fact that the faith was first in them, Lois and Eunice, and then in him. And so we infer from that that probably his father was not a believer. Whether he had been in the category of a man like those other worshipers of God who were Gentiles that we've already encountered, we just don't know. We don't know anything really about his father. There could have been a lot of motivations for his Greek father not to want him to be circumcised. Circumcision, you can read volumes on this, but you probably don't want to read all those volumes on circumcision anyway. But circumcision was something that was really despised, and I already mentioned this yesterday, really despised in Greek and Roman culture. They saw it as mutilation. Because of that, from the time of the Seleucid rule over Judea and the conquest by Alexander's forces over that portion of the world, the Jews in the diaspora and even the Jews in Judea had issues about circumcision. How much had to be cut off in order for it to be legitimate? There were debates about that. You know, could they just take a small clipping of the foreskin and then not be at odds with this culture, this Greek culture, that was kind of into phallic worship and all that? Or how radical did it have to be? And there was an operation that could be performed that involved cutting and stretching and all kinds of really grotesque things in order to undo a circumcision. Paul makes reference to that in Galatians. He also makes reference to that when he says in Romans, the 7th chapter, is anyone circumcised when he's called? Let him not become uncircumcised. There was a procedure, and there were, in fact, multiple procedures, but to undo a circumcision. Because if a Jew wanted to blend into the culture, a Jewish male could not be circumcised and blend in. There were these circumstances of public nudity. There was one trial that was recorded historically back in the first century where a man was on trial, and part of what was against him was that he was Jewish, and he denied being Jewish, and they stripped him in the courtroom, and yeah, you're Jewish, all right. You know, there were issues involved in that. And a lot of Jews in the diaspora were reluctant to be circumcised. But Paul, in order to avoid controversy, in order to have Timothy be as effective as he could, and it says, because of the Jews, had nothing to do with his salvation, and so Paul had Timothy circumcised before he took him, added him to their party, and took him on along. And Timothy clearly was willing to do that. And we should realize, I think, that Timothy, in making that decision, was cutting certain... Sorry. But he was cutting certain opportunities that might have been his otherwise with the Greek side of his heritage. He was cutting ties with the past. He was eliminating some opportunities that his Greek father may have intended to keep open for him as an adult. So at any rate, Paul did circumcise Timothy in order to take him along. And we have reference in 1 Timothy 1:18 to prophecies made about Timothy. What Luke says is the brethren spoke well of him, and he doesn't get into any particulars about what was said of Timothy, just that the brethren spoke well of him. We have in 1 Timothy 4:12 through 14 that Timothy had had the laying on of the hands of the eldership. The elders had laid hands on him. And that Timothy had a spiritual gift, which he received at that time, the time when the elders laid hands on him. Now, do we know whether there were elders at Lystra? Yes or no? Yes, we know there were elders at Lystra, because we were told about the appointment of them at the end of the 14th chapter. So we know there were elders in Lystra. There were men in the church there that would fit the circumstances Paul describes. And then over in 1 Timothy 1:5 and 6, not only did Paul mention Timothy's faith and its background, but he also mentioned to fan into flame the gift that is in you by the laying on of my hands. So he received a gift in conjunction with the laying, he said, at the time when the elders laid hands on him. But the specific mechanism that Paul mentioned in 2 Timothy was Paul himself laying hands on Timothy. So Timothy was commissioned by the elders, and I have every confidence this happened at the time we're reading about here in Acts chapter 16 in these first three verses, that this is when the elders at Lystra laid hands on Timothy to send him to go with Paul and Silas, and Paul made full use of him as a man who was capable of preaching the gospel and handling responsibility even though he was young. And that Paul also laid hands on him, and that Timothy received some spiritual gift, which we don't know what it was, but Paul told him not to neglect it. Don't neglect the gift you have. And we, none of us should neglect whatever gifts we have, whatever God has given to us. We're told that in the, you know, this parable of the talents and other of the stories that the Lord told. Whatever you've got, put it to use in the house of God, and put this money to work until I come again. In the story, the parable of the 10 minas. We need to utilize what God has given to us. And that included, for Timothy's situation, included some spiritual gift that would be of advantage to him in his preaching. And that says to me, among other things, you know, when Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he talked about spiritual gifts, earnestly desire the greater gifts, which suggests to me, along with him telling Timothy, don't neglect your gift. These gifts were not static. That people, as they applied themselves and used the gift of God, as they exercised what God had given to them, they grew more capable in the use of even those spiritual gifts. So, and in connection with that, I was given a question about, which I thought I put in my pocket. Which pocket did I put it in? Some preachers are sent out. Paul and Barnabas were sent out, right? Silas and Judas were sent out. Here we have Timothy being sent out. Some preachers are sent out after they've been hired by a congregation. Clarify, please. And I don't know anything in the New Testament. No, I don't know anything in the New Testament about a preacher being hired by a congregation. I do know of preachers that were preaching being supported by churches, but I don't know anything about preachers in the New Testament being hired by a congregation. Preachers in the New Testament are not hired into churches, they're sent out by churches. And we see that consistently, as in the stories that we've already looked at here, and as in the story that we have right here with Timothy. That's a persistent picture, that churches, particularly with elders, but Barnabas is sent out by the church in Jerusalem. Later, Barnabas and Paul are sent out by the church in Antioch. And Timothy from the elders here at Lystra, and Paul and Silas from the church in Jerusalem. But this is what we see in the New Testament consistently, that those who go to do the work of the Lord, and they are sent out by theirs. Meanwhile, we do have, when these men are at home, as well as others, are engaged in teaching and preaching the Word of God, as we had there in the 15th chapter of Acts, regarding Paul and Silas, Paul and Tim. Who was Paul's friend? Paul and Barnabas, there in Antioch. So Acts 16, carrying on to verses 4 and 5, as Paul and Silas traveled through that region, it says they gave copies of the letter from the apostles and the elders to the churches, traveled from town to town, delivered the decisions reached by the apostles and elders in Jerusalem for people to obey. And so the churches were strengthened in the faith and grew daily in numbers. The churches were getting stronger and growing all the time. And that's a picture Luke often gives us. In spite of hardship, oppression, resistance, persecution, we see very often the churches are full of people who are finding joy in the Lord and sharing their faith with other people, so that the faith is growing, not churches are growing in the faith and also growing in numbers from day to day. Chapter 16, verses 6 through 8 gives us a depiction of them traveling onward through Phrygia and Galatia. And again, I have suggested that the Galatian letter was probably written just before this trip, but may have been written a little further along in the trip. Either of those are possibilities. I'm strongly inclined to the former, that they wrote it and then Paul went to the region as a follow-up. But passing through Phrygia and Galatia, Paul wanted to go to Asia, and the Lord said, you know, you can't speak in Asia. We don't know how that message came, but they were prevented from speaking in Asia. Was it just, you know, like a verbal message, or was there something else? I don't know. But they could not go and preach in Asia, and they were not even to enter Bithynia. Now, much later than this, well, a dozen years later than this, when Peter wrote 1 Peter, he mentioned saints in Bithynia. So we know the gospel went to Bithynia, but we don't know who took it there or when it was taken there. But Paul and Silas were forbidden to even go into Bithynia. The time wasn't right. Something wasn't right. Things don't always go according to our plans. Paul thought Asia, and the Lord said no. And they thought Bithynia, and the Lord said no, don't even go there. So their plans didn't work out just the way they had in mind. An example, I think an example of that sort of thing is in the story of the Ethiopian eunuch, which is when Paul was still a persecutor. But in the story of the Ethiopian eunuch, this man had gone all the way from Ethiopia to Jerusalem to worship in Jerusalem. So he clearly was a practicing Jew, and we can say more about that, but not my subject. He clearly was a practicing Jew. He'd been to worship at the temple, and as he's going home, he has a copy of the scroll of Isaiah, which is very expensive and not that easy to get a hold of, because everything is hand-copied and so forth. But he has been to Jerusalem. Is there a church in Jerusalem? Well, yeah, there's lots of believers in Jerusalem, even apostles in Jerusalem at this point in time. But he has left Jerusalem and is on his way back home when the Holy Spirit tells Philip to go down here. And so he is directed to this road, and Philip encounters this man on the road and hears him as he's riding along in his chariot reading aloud from the book of Isaiah. And Philip came up close and said, you know what you're reading about there? Well, how can I if someone doesn't teach me? And so he invites Philip into the chariot. And that's the time for this man to become a Christian. Not the day before when he was in Jerusalem with Christians in the city, with apostles available, but that day out on the road. And the Lord provided the right man in the right time to meet his need. Well, this wasn't the time for Asia and Bithynia. A little later, Paul's going to go through Asia and have all kinds of opportunities open up to him. But not now. Not right now. And so the Lord has his way. They didn't go to Asia. They didn't go to Bithynia. They really didn't know where to go. And they came over to the coast, the west coast of Turkey there, of Asia there, and they came over to Troas. And in Troas, Paul had a vision of a Macedonian. It's evident there's already a church in Troas. Paul didn't start a congregation there. It seems evident in the storyline that there's already a church in Troas. But in Troas, Paul had a vision of a Macedonian man asking for help. And so they decided, well, the Lord wants us to go to Macedonia. And what happens right here in Acts chapter 16, verse 9, during the night, Paul had a vision of a man of Macedonia standing and begging him, come over to Macedonia and help us. After Paul had seen the vision, we got ready at once to leave for Macedonia, concluding that Paul had called us to preach the gospel to them. And so who is now in the party that had not previously been in the party for the very first time? Luke, the author of the book, because he uses that plural personal pronoun. We and us. We concluded, and so we went to, he called us to preach the gospel to them. So by the time we leave Troas, and this suggests to me that Luke was from Troas, and there's other things that suggest that to me as well, but Luke was, after this, a frequent companion of Paul. They didn't always work together. Sometimes Luke did follow-up work in Paul's behalf, but later when Paul goes to Jerusalem, Luke goes with him, and when Paul goes to Rome, Luke goes with him, and of course Luke is the one who ends up writing this account and telling us about the works of Peter and Paul in the early days of the church. But it's very likely Luke was from Troas, and he and Paul now joined company, and so we have Paul and Silas and Timothy and Luke traveling together. Whether that's all that's in the party, I don't know, but those are the ones that are given to us by name. The Lord had called us to go to preach the gospel to them in Macedonia. So Luke is now a part of the group as they go on from there. And it's going to be a great relationship between Paul and Luke as time goes by. And Luke tells us that they went from Troas up here by sea up to Samothrace, and then from Samothrace across, and you can see the red line there, from Samothrace across to Neapolis, which is a port on the coast of Macedonia. And Macedonia, I think, today is under Turkish rule. It's one of those disputed territories that Greeks and Turkey don't get along about. But anyway, they went across to Macedonia, and then next to Neapolis is the city of Philippi, which was their destination at this point in time. It's about 10 miles, but Neapolis served as the seaport for Philippi. It wasn't a big and important town, but it was important because it was a seaport for Philippi. So they went on to Philippi in Macedonia. Now, for whatever reason, this particular map, which came from a Bible atlas, from a book, says Luke joins Paul at Neapolis up there, if you're trying to read the small print. And that's not true. Luke joined Paul at Troas, and I don't know how that particular mistake worked its way in, but, you know, sometimes mistakes work their way into printed text that gets shared. So they went on, they went to Philippi, and the remainder of the story in the 16th chapter of Acts is about what happened in Philippi. And I think these stories are probably fairly familiar to many of us, at least, most of us probably. In Acts 16:12, Luke tells us that Philippi was a leading city of Macedonia and a Roman colony. And I want to just insert a comment here from a Bible exposition commentary about what that means, that it was a Roman colony. The emperor organized colonies by ordering Roman citizens, especially retired military people, to live in selected places so there would be strong pro-Roman cities in these strategic areas. Does that reasoning make sense to you? You've got all these conquered lands, all these peoples who are not Italian, who are not Roman. This one city dominating all of these countries, and you'd like to have some places where you've got, you know, hardline supporters of the empire. And so you establish these cities, and you give them special privileges. They're a Roman colony where Roman citizens with presumed loyalty because of past service to the empire and because of privileges given by the emperor, that they're going to support Rome come what may. And they're planted in the midst of these various regions of the Roman Empire. So Philippi is such a place. It's a city with certain privileges, tax exemptions, and special privileges from the emperor in order to ensure loyalty with a core of Roman citizens, people who are citizens of Rome, who live there, who have been asked to live there by imperial edict. So it would be a strong pro-Roman stronghold, these cities in these strategic areas. Though living on foreign soil, the citizens were expected to be loyal to Rome, to obey the laws of Rome, and to give honor to the Roman emperor. In return, they were given certain political privileges, not the least of which was exemption from taxes. This was their reward for leaving their homes in Italy and relocating elsewhere. So Philippi is that kind of city. It is a Roman colony, Luke tells us, and history agrees with that, of course. It is a Roman colony. So on the Sabbath, where would Paul and Silas go on the Sabbath? To the synagogue, but they didn't. Not because they wouldn't, but presumably because they couldn't. What did it take to establish? I didn't talk about this when I talked about synagogue, but what was required to establish a synagogue in any city? 10 practicing Jews, 10 men, 10 practicing males. You had to have 10 men to constitute a synagogue. And if 10 men didn't show up for the service, you couldn't do synagogue meeting that day. You needed 10 men. Consequently, in some cities where they had wealth and power, but not necessarily a lot of fidelity, they would hire men of low estate, Jewish men, but men of low estate, and they would pay them to be there just so they could have a quorum in order to have a synagogue meeting. But it required 10 men, 10 practicing Jewish men to be there in order to have a synagogue and for that meeting to take place. So on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to a riverside where we were supposing there would be a place of prayer. This is option number 2. If you don't have a synagogue, then meeting out by the river in a place of prayer would be a custom that they expected to take place. And they probably had asked around, where would this happen? Where would this be? And so we sat down and began speaking to the women who had assembled there. So Philippi was an important city, and it had these privileges of being a Roman colony. But Philippi apparently did not have enough active Jews to have a synagogue. And the people gathered at the riverside, Luke emphasizes that this is women that they're talking to there. Now, you can take this however you will. I don't mean to make too much of it, but Paul sets out from Troas with a call to go to Macedonia, and it's a Macedonian man who calls, come over and help us, and he arrives in Philippi thinking, here we go, and there's not even a synagogue there. And what they've got is some women meeting by the riverside. But he doesn't refrain from preaching to the women. He certainly went ahead and preached Christ to the women who had assembled there. And a woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple fabrics, a worshiper of God, was listening. And I think when Luke tells us a worshiper of God, he's telling us this woman isn't even actually a Jew herself. She's there with the others who are Jewish, but she herself is in that category like Cornelius. She follows the moral teachings of the law, but she has not proselytized. She has not become a Jew. She's a worshiper of God, and she's there with the others who are gathered for prayer by the river. She's not even a local, but she does have a business that's successful, and she's got a home, and she's got servants, and so forth. A worshiper of God, she was listening, and the Lord opened her heart to respond to the things spoken by Paul. And I like that expression, the people on the day of Pentecost who responded to the message, what's it say? It says they were cut to the heart. Well, it says she was cut to the heart, but it says her heart was open. The Lord opened her heart to receive this message. And so she responded to the things spoken by Paul. And again, the Ethiopian on the road. The day before, the Lord didn't say, I think somebody could open his heart. But the day that he was in the chariot heading down the Azotus road there, that day it was a good time for the message to come to him, and the Lord arranged to bring it. And I appreciate the fact, and I don't think the Lord has quit working in this way. I think that the Lord will bring answers when people are in a fit mood and open to receive answers. And so the Lord brought her this message at the right time. And when she and her household had been baptized, well, what were they doing? They were speaking to the women there, and, well, just like the Ethiopian somewhere in there, baptism was part of the message. So she and her household were baptized, and she urged us, saying, if you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and stay. And this is a little bit of an unusual social circumstance here, but they decided that it was a good idea, and so they went and stayed at the home of Lydia. She prevailed upon us. The very way she words it shows us that it was an unusual social circumstance for a traveling body of four men to come and stay in the house of a woman. No indication that she had a husband. She has a household. She has people associated with her, probably at least servants, if not family members. But they prevailed on her. She prevailed on us. It was a matter of persuasion. Showed her hospitality, and they couldn't turn her down, and so they went and stayed at her house. Now, the story in Philippi goes on to tell us about a servant girl who had a spirit of divination. And every day she started following Paul and Silas when they would go out to the riverside, when they'd go out to the place of prayer, when they'd move around the city. This girl started following them around. And Luke says that she was a source of a lot of money for her owners, because she would give these fortune-telling kinds of answers, and apparently in a gifted way. There was an actual spirit involved in that, a spirit of divination. And so she kept following them around for many days, and she's acclaiming that they're servants of Jesus Christ, that their message is genuine. But it's kind of like when Jesus would deal with demons. What did Jesus pretty much always tell the demons who acknowledged his identity? Be quiet. Be quiet. Yeah. Over and over again, he told the demons, be quiet, when he would cast them out. What do you want with me, Jesus of Nazareth? Jesus, son of... They would call him all these things that indicated his identity. Well, that wasn't the testimony he was looking for, and he would silence them in the process of casting them out. And this girl, it says, kept on doing this for many days, but Paul was greatly annoyed. And that's actually why I put this verse in here. Paul was a guy, not that different from us, and this it irritated him that she kept doing this. He was annoyed by what she was doing. And he turned and said to the Spirit, I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her. And it came out at that very moment. And this is not the last time we'll see Paul casting out spirits. But Paul cast the spirit out. And why did he do it? Because he was annoyed by the situation. Do you ever do something because you're annoyed? annoyance isn't really a good thing, but it is a part of human life. We do things because we're annoyed. He did. This wasn't a bad thing. I'm not at all suggesting he did a bad thing, although the people who owned the girl thought it was a bad thing. But I would not suggest that what he did was a bad thing. Her life probably became normal after that. She was going around like someone who was really not in control of her own senses and her own actions here, even though it doesn't call it demon possession. Nevertheless, she is behaving in an irrational way, following them around and shouting these things every day. So when Paul was annoyed, he commanded the spirit to come out of her. And then the result of that is that Paul and Silas were arrested. The owners of the girl raised a ruckus, accused them of taking away their livelihood. They were arrested and beaten at the command of the magistrates, and they were put in jail. What happened while they were in jail? What were they doing in jail? Praying and singing. Okay, they were praying and singing. And about midnight, what happened while they were in jail? There was an earthquake, and the doors opened and the chains fell off. Earthquakes do that all the time, knock chains off of people and stuff, right? The doors opened and the chains fell off. And about that time, the jailer woke up, and what did he think had happened? He clearly thought everybody got away. And if everybody got away, his life was forfeit. You lose a prisoner, Roman soldier, you have to pay the price, your life for his life. So he is about to take his own life, and Paul speaks up and says, "We're all here, don't harm yourself." And the jailer said, "What must I do to be saved?" Well, they just saved him, but that's not what he's talking about. He'd heard some stuff. He'd heard them talking. He'd heard them praying and singing. He maybe had heard some other stuff around town before that. And so they tell him about Jesus. They tell him about baptism. He takes them home, bathes their wounds, feeds them. And then the next morning when the magistrates say, "Okay, turn those guys loose," Paul said, "Not quite that easy. Ask them if it was legal what they did to Roman citizens." So Paul and Silas played the card that they were Roman citizens. Why would they do that? Was Paul being vindictive here? I don't think so. I think Paul wanted to set a precedent that you don't just throw Christians around just any time and every time you want to. I think he was setting a precedent for other believers that you need to stop and think and not just react. He had been mistreated and abused many times by the Jews. He wasn't at all ready to have the government now just start mistreating and abusing him and other believers anytime people wanted to. So they played that card, I think, in a strategic way to make the point that Christians could be people with rights too. And so they brought that up, and as a result of that, the magistrates came personally to escort them out, and they were apologetic, and they were begging them, "Don't make an issue of this," but they also begged them to please go away. "Please leave town. Please go away." And so they left. Paul and Silas left, and they took Timothy with them, but Luke stayed behind. And that has bearing on the story of Paul, but it has bearing on the story of Philippi even more so. As we go along and see Paul in his interaction with churches, and I'm going to do a segment on this next week, but again and again, Paul received help from Macedonian churches. And when Paul wrote to the Corinthians about the collection for the saints, he says, "And the Macedonian churches, beyond their means, they contributed." And that was right at the time when Luke rejoined Paul after having been separated for a few years, while Luke stayed behind in Macedonia and worked with the churches there. But the Macedonian churches, the church at Philippi, we see it as a healthy, growing church, very much so. And the Macedonian churches are characterized for their generosity, especially Philippi. But the Macedonian churches are characterized for their generosity. And Luke had a hand in that. The teaching that he did, he stayed behind and he continued teaching and working with those churches. And when Paul wrote to the Philippian church, Luke wasn't there anymore. Luke was with him in Rome. But he wrote to a church that had elders and deacons and had sent out a preacher named Epaphroditus to come up to Rome and work alongside him. So the Philippian church that Luke spent some time with after Paul, Silas, and Timothy had to leave became a healthy, vibrant example of how churches ought to perform, how they ought to operate. Acts chapter 17, we continue in Macedonia, but having left Philippi after the abuse they received there, they went on to Thessalonica. And in the Thessalonian letter, in the second chapter of 1 Thessalonians, Paul mentions, and I didn't put it on the slide here, but Paul mentions how difficult it was to preach in Thessalonica after what had happened in Philippi. You get beat up one day, and the next day you go on down to the next town, and you start right in doing the thing that got you in trouble the last place you were. And we should realize, because Paul makes a point of it several times, it was really very difficult to rise above the dread and the fear of what was going to happen. If I do this, I'm going to get in trouble. Well, I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway, because it's worth it. It's worth the cost. And so he did what he knew to be worth the cost, even though he knew there would be a cost. So they went on from Philippi to Thessalonica, just if in the previous map up here, just moving a little ways southward here to Thessalonica. From Philippi in Macedonia to Thessalonica in Macedonia. And we're in Acts chapter 17 and verses 1 through 15. Oh, I should mention that it did say when they left, they went to Lydia's house and met with the brethren. So Lydia hosted the church for a while, at least there in Philippi. And they left a young, fledgling congregation, but a congregation that was, you've got Lydia and you've got the jailer, and we don't know how many others had been converted in their coming and going, but they left behind a working congregation with Luke to help them for a time. So they went on to Thessalonica and Macedonia, and for three Sabbaths, they were reasoning in the synagogue. I don't know how long they spent in Thessalonica, but for three Sabbaths, they were reasoning in the synagogue before things turned sour, before things began to get nasty. And some Jews and many God-fearing Greeks and leading women were converted. Again, we see this mix of people that Luke highlights that become a part of the church. Some Greeks or God-fearing Greeks who are not proselytes, but are followers of the tenets of the law in many ways, and leading women of influence in the community there, as well as some of the Jews. But there was violence. We have Jewish adversaries once again stirring up violence against Paul and Silas and Timothy. And so they went on down to Berea. And a lot of us would know the verse here regarding the Bereans, that those at Berea were more noble than those of Thessalonica. And why was that? Because they searched the scriptures daily to see whether these things were true. All right, so they went to Berea, which is still in Macedonia. And as they preached in the synagogue, they had the opportunity to present these ideas, and the Berean Jews would search. Now, you think of that, and everybody pulled out their Bible, right? No. What did they do? They got the scrolls out, and they poured through the scrolls. And not everybody had a scroll. The synagogue had scrolls, not the individuals. And so they're pouring over these scrolls. Is this what these scriptures... They didn't have, a handy-dandy concordance or electronic Bible or even a personal Bible. But they search the scriptures. They're pouring through those scrolls to be sure. That is what it says, isn't it? This is what they're checking it out and making sure whether the preaching of Jesus is consistent with what the prophet said. And that was going along very well. But the Jews up the road in Thessalonica that had already been fighting this heard of the work, and so they came down to Berea to stir up trouble. They came down and succeeded in doing so. Because of the trouble that was stirred up now by the Thessalonian Jews that came down to Berea, it seemed good for Paul to leave town. Paul wore out his welcome in so many places. Now the brethren typically, even though we have Paul defending his apostleship to the Galatians and Corinthians, we also had Paul saying, "You would have torn out your eyes for me when I was there." The love they had for him was very evident when he had been among them. And he talks about that love and that bond in others of his letters. Typically, he was well loved by the brethren that he preached to and that he had brought into the faith. But he also had many viral enemies, enemies who were determined to put an end to him and an end to his message. And so, once again, in Berea, it looked like a good idea for Paul to get out of town. And so he went on south, out of Macedonia and into Achaia, Greece. He went down into Greece, into Achaia, and went as far as Athens. We're told that the brethren who escorted him were going to take him as far as the seacoast, but they took him to Athens. And so Paul remained in Athens, but as they went back up to Berea, he said, "Tell Silas and Timothy to join me as soon as they can. Tell them to join me as..." And he also must have given an instruction at that point for them to tell Timothy to go to Thessalonica, because that's what we're told in the Thessalonian letter. But Paul went to Athens by himself, and Timothy and Silas stayed behind in Macedonia. So now, on the map, we're down in the blue portion over here. We have jumped down via the seacoast from Berea to Athens, a good long distance from Berea up in the orange portion up there down to Athens in the blue portions. And then, while Paul is there at Athens, and the only attribution that we have is that he went to Athens to wait for them. It doesn't say he was going to do anything else. He went to Athens to wait for them and said to have them come as soon as they could. So while Paul is there in Athens, we're told that Paul then was looking around, and you know, there was a lot of stuff to see in Athens. We have, you know, the Parthenon, the Acropolis there, the mountain, and we had all kinds of these beautiful structures that had been raised up several hundred years before in the classical Greek period, the heyday of Greek world influence. And the city was really quite spectacular, but what Paul looked around and saw a whole bunch of was idols. He looked around and saw idols everywhere, and that really bothered him. Now, when Paul was there in Athens, he had encounters with philosophers a couple of times, more than a couple of times, but in some fairly profound way. And it made me think about what Paul had to say about philosophers broadly in 1 Corinthians 1:20. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Now, this is several years after. He's writing Corinthians several years after his visit to Athens. But his assessment of human philosophy was not particularly flattering. When man starts with himself, he doesn't arrive at a lot of helpful conclusions. And that's the nature of philosophy. You start with man. You start with yourself and try to work outward from there and derive truth. And it leads to a lot of unhappiness, dissatisfaction, discontent. And has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Or in Colossians 2:8, when he wrote, see to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ. And that's not to say that all philosophers are bad or that all the conclusions of philosophy are wrong, but you're starting on a wrong base when you start with philosophy. You're starting with the wrong set of preconceptions when you're trying to investigate and draw your conclusions. The book of Ecclesiastes is a pretty good example of what Paul's talking about here, because Solomon, in the book of Ecclesiastes, basically says, I set out by wisdom to test and find out what's good. And what did he say over and over again in the course of reiterating what he had tried in the book, in his experimentation? Well, it's vanity of vanities, right? I found everything to be empty and chasing after the wind. And at the end of the book, and I think almost against his will, he is left with saying, you know, the final conclusion is you need to first of all remember God while you're young before the bad times come, and you'll say, I have no pleasure in them. And let's hear the conclusion of the whole matter, fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole of man, the whole duty of man, the whole purpose, the very substance of man. And philosophy can answer certain kinds of questions, but the ultimate questions of origins and life, purpose, it can't really answer those kinds of questions. So Paul did not come away from his meeting in Athens with a sense that these guys were really wise and on track. He didn't come away with that sort of conclusion at all. In Acts 17:15-17, those who escorted Paul brought him as far as Athens, and receiving a command for Silas and Timothy to come to him as soon as possible, they left. Now, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was observing the city full of idols. So he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be present. Now, not only was Athens a place where lots of philosophers gathered, it was a place that prided itself on being a place where lots of philosophers gathered. A center of philosophy, a center of clever thinking, of wisdom. And that would have an impact on the Jewish population there, I think, as well as on the population at large. So I notice, again, and emphasize, I mentioned it, and I want to emphasize Paul's reaction to what he saw. He did not, from anything I read in the storyline, he did not go to Athens to preach. But once he got there, he couldn't help it. He was provoked by what he saw. And again, I think that if the Spirit of God is in us, if we believe what we profess to believe, that sometimes when we confront the world, when we confront what's going on in the world around us, the morality, the lack of morality, the idolatry, the values that people pursue, sometimes you just have to speak. You just have to speak up and tell the truth about the Lord. And Paul was at that kind of a place in Athens. He was provoked. His spirit provoked within him as he observed the city full of idols. And so he began to go again into the synagogue, speaking to the God-fearing Gentiles as well as the Jews in the marketplaces. Do you like it when somebody comes up to you in the marketplace to talk to you about some religious or political thing? I don't like that at all. I don't know if they like that at all, but Paul did that. He went and circulated in the marketplace and talked to whomever he could. And after some public discussion with Epicurean and Stoic philosophers who believed utterly different things and yet weren't really very different in practice at all. You know, the Stoics, you just deny everything in order to be happy, and the Epicureans, you just indulge in everything to be happy. But either way, you're just trying your best to be happy. You're trying to find contentment within yourself. And they invited Paul to come to their assembly at the Areopagus. The Areopagus here is not in the background. That's the Acropolis and that's the Parthenon. The Areopagus here is the hill in the foreground. They invited Paul to meet them at the hill, Mars Hill it's called in the old King James Version there, to meet them at the hill of Ares, the hill of the god of war there. Anyway, they're going to meet at this place where they came together for open discussion and so forth, where the philosophers met together. And the hill in the foreground here, as I understand, is the physical location of the assembly at the Areopagus. And so Paul did come, and Paul did meet with them there. And at the meeting of the philosophers, what did Paul talk about? Well, I think there's a contrast here that's worth noticing. I'm not going to go back and point by point compare these things. But when Paul was in Antioch of Pisidia and he went to the synagogue there, Luke gave us at least a shortened lesson of what outline of what Paul said there. And Paul started out by saying, you know, men of Israel and God-fearing Gentiles, you men of Israel and you God-fearing people, the God of our fathers, he chose our fathers. He brought Moses. He established, you know, he goes through about 450 years of Moses and the judges and all these things. And then he brought Saul to the kingship and replaced him with David. And then the sons of David and bringing John the Baptist. And he goes through an outline of the Old Testament. And he cites several scriptures in order to make his case. How many scriptures did Paul quote when he was at the Areopagus? He didn't quote scripture. Why not? Because this gathering of men didn't know scripture. They didn't know this stuff. So what did he do? And it had to be a little bit daunting in some ways, but nevertheless, it's something to bear in mind when you're talking to people. And while, you know, we were a nation in which a vast majority of people had some knowledge of Christian faith in the Bible, increasingly, I think you will find that there are people, especially those people who are under, I'll pick 35 as an arbitrary age, but especially those people who are younger, know virtually nothing. They have ideas that have been inculcated by the media about Christians, narrow, bigoted people that we are, but they have no clear concept of what the Bible teaches. They couldn't quote a verse if their life depended on it. They just don't know this stuff. They haven't been exposed to it. They haven't had any reason to think they were interested in it. And so we have Paul talking to people who are in this predicament. They don't know anything about the Bible. They don't know the Old Testament. They don't know those characters. And so what we have Paul doing is, first off, he starts talking about their religion. I see you're a very religious people. The King James has superstitious, but I don't think it was meant to be insulting. And most versions have. I see you're very religious people. I went through your city and I saw all these altars to all these deities that are worshipped here. And I noticed one in particular that said it was dedicated to an unknown God. And I want to talk to you about the unknown God. So he starts from something they could identify with, something. He didn't start off with being in their face of how badly wrong they were. He started off with talking about something they could identify with and use that as a basis to talk about the transcendent, self-sufficient Creator who's the source of all things. He talked about the Creator. The God who made everything. He's the one who made all the nations of the earth. Some of the things that he said there would have been off-putting to them, and Paul knew it when he said it. when he said that God made all men of one man, the Greeks thought they were something special. They thought they were a special race. They weren't the only ones to think that ever, were they? But they thought they were a special race. And when he says this about God making of one man all men, that was a little bit of a challenge to them to think in those terms. But he spoke of a transcendent God, a God who is not in any way dependent on or connected into this universe, and yet who is over it utterly, who has complete power over it. The self-sufficient creator, he doesn't need people to bring him offerings. He doesn't get hungry. He isn't in any way dependent on humankind. And from him come all good things, including life itself. All these things come from God. He talked about the common human longing for God, that God isn't far from any of us, and that we have a longing, and that was depicted by all the stuff that they were doing in that city, that there's a longing for God. He talked about the closeness of God, that he is within reach for anyone who reaches out to him. Paul quoted from the poet Epimenides, "For in him we live and move and have our being." And then he added a quotation that's in two different poets, Aratus and Cleanthes, "For we are also his offspring." So he tossed out these lines from the poets that a number of them would have recognized the source and would have realized he had read something. He was not illiterate. He'd read something and could talk about these things. And he said, God commands everyone everywhere to repent. Being ignorant and doing all this stuff with gold and stone and all that, God put up with it, but God wants everyone everywhere to repent. And he has testified to this. He set a day for judgment, and he's testified to this by raising Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus Christ, from the dead. And we were told, if we backed up in the story, that when the Epicureans and Stoics were talking to Paul, they said, he's talking about some new gods, this Jesus and resurrection. And a lot of gods had names that went along with functions, and they thought maybe resurrection was the name of a god, because bodily resurrection was not a part of Greek thought, Greek culture, was not something that they considered a possibility. And when Paul got to the place where he said God had raised Jesus from the dead, that's the place where the audience started talking among themselves and everything kind of broke up, because a lot of them thought that sounded like nonsense. They thought that sounded ridiculous. Not all of them. Some of them became believers. Some of them followed. We have not only the fact that some, but we have a couple of names there of folks who accepted what Paul was saying and became followers. Many scoffed, a few were still curious, and some believed as a result of what happened there at the Areopagus, there at Mars Hill in Athens, in that conversation with... we're not ready for that. We are, in fact, done for today, and you have a 10-minute break before Doug, right? Doug is next on the program. Right now we have a 10-minute break, and tomorrow we will go on to Corinth and the circumstance of Paul writing another of his letters.